The following is a recording of the Thomas Paine Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. We are located in Collegeville, Pennsylvania. We are also located on the web at www.tpuuf.org. Please come visit us.
Good morning and welcome to Thomas Paine Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. We are located in Collegeville, Pennsylvania, but this morning, wherever you are, that's where we are. Wherever you are in your spiritual journey, we welcome you. Wherever you are in your life journey, we welcome you. Whomever you love, whatever your gender, identity, or expression, we welcome you. Whether you are a newcomer or a long-term member or anything in between, we welcome you. And if you are a newcomer, we invite you to fill out our virtual visitor card, which you will find as a link appearing in the chat. We want to welcome you this morning and use this as an opportunity to get to know you and for you to ask us for any information that you'd like to have. I'm the Reverend Larry Pierce, minister at Thomas Paine Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. We want to welcome our guest preacher this morning, the Reverend Catherine Rohde. I've known Kate as a colleague for a long time, and I was just so glad to hear that she and her husband had returned to the area recently. She's a retired minister and is minister emerita from the Unitarian Congregation of Westchester, Pennsylvania, where she lives. And she's also served congregations in Georgia, British Columbia, Florida, California, and Texas. So welcome back, Reverend Rohde. As we bring ourselves into this place, into this moment of worship, I want us to begin with these opening words. So press one palm against another so that you sense your body in this moment. And let's take a few conscious breaths. As we breathe in at a silent count of six and out at a silent count of seven a few times. As you breathe in peace. As you breathe out love. Our opening words are from a short song by Phil Porter, who is a dancer and a minister. And these words appear as a song in our Unitarian Universalist hymnal. Many of you know this. Let these be our opening words. Gathered here in the mystery of the hour, gathered here in one strong body, gather here in the struggle and the power, Spirit, draw near. So may it be. Before we read in unison our chalice lighting words this morning that will soon appear as a slide, I want to give you just a short background. So as Unitarian Universalists, we are among those religious traditions that do not have a creed. We don't bind ourselves to a creed, I should say. Our ancestors, Congregationalists and Unitarians in New England and Universalists often agreed to covenants and not creeds. They committed themselves as congregations to walk together, guided by particular qualities of relationship. So covenant is an agreement. It's a taking a stand for something that matters. It says that all who enter our circle commit to these ways of being with one another, these ways of relating to each other and to the world. This particular covenant was written by James Villa Blake in the early 1900s and has been adopted by many Unitarian Universalist churches today. So after I light this candle of our chalice, let us join in the chorus of voices over the decades and up until this very moment, as we say these words together in unison. Love is the spirit of this church, and service is its law. This is our great covenant, to dwell together in peace, to seek the truth in love, and to help one another. And now Preston will light our peace lamp.
After I light the peace lamp, your response will be, and with all the people of the world. May peace be with you, and with all the people of the world.
Our gathering song, the lyrics will appear on a slide. It's number 318, We Would Be One. Now our conversation and story will be presented to us by Reverend Kate Rohde.
It's good to be with you this morning. And this story is maybe a common story, but maybe a little bit of a different take on it. When you're my age, there are things that you think are common experiences, but then you realize, it happened a long time ago, and maybe not everybody has had that experience. But when I was younger than I am now, one of the fun things about traveling was that you got to meet strangers, people you might never meet in regular life, and have long conversations. When you traveled by train, it could be a very long conversation. You might be together for a day or two. But the time I'm thinking of, there were plane rides, and I almost every summer and every Christmas would take a long plane ride, 3 or 4 hours from where I live to my family in the West. And most of the time, I'd be sitting next to someone and we'd start up a conversation. Not always. Sometimes people would make it really clear they weren't up for a conversation, like they'd put a book in front of their head and not look at you. But generally, people were. And you got to hear stories that you might never hear. I remember, though, one time I was a little hesitant. The young man sitting next to me was maybe about 10 or 15 years younger than me. He was dressed in very sort of in fashion clothes for that era. And he was African-American, and he looked a little grumpy, kind of his, not really grumpy, but his face looked very serious. And I wasn't sure whether he'd want to talk to me or not, but I decided to give it a try. And it was one of the more memorable times for me because turned out he was in a rock band, and the rock band he was in was of a rock star that was one of my favorites when I was a kid. Now, this guy probably wasn't even in this world when I was a kid, but still, that band was still going on and he was traveling all over the country. The rock star's name was Chubby Checkers. And for the old people among us, you'll remember that he taught the whole country how to do the twist. So this young man told me about the life of being on the road and what it was like to travel in a band. And he was very friendly and we had a great conversation and I really enjoyed it. And I was glad that I'd taken the risk, even though I wasn't sure he really would want to chat with me. And I think that's often the way. I grew up in the West and we talked to strangers. We talked to, the lady at the checkout counter or the man in the shoe store or, someone else sitting on the bus. That was part of, I guess, growing up in the West, you knew you might not see other people as often as you liked. So you always took the chance to have a chat and get to know a new person in your space. And that's something I think we could do more of in our world today. One of my favorite poems is William Stafford, who hails from Oregon, like I do. And this is his poem, A Ritual to Read to Each Other. If you don't know the kind of person I am, and I don't know the kind of person you are, a pattern that others made may prevail in the world, and following the wrong God home, we may miss our star. For there is many a small betrayal in the mind, a shrug that lets the fragile sequence break, sending with shouts the horrible errors of childhood storming out to play through the broken dark dike. And as elephants parade, holding each elephant's tail, but if one wanders, the circus won't find the park. I call it cruel, and maybe the root of all cruelty, to know what occurs, but not recognize the fact. And so I appeal to a voice, to something shadowy, to a remote, important region in all who talk. Though we could fool each other, we should consider, lest the parade of our mutual life get lost in the dark. For it's important that awake people be awake, or a breaking line may discourage them back to sleep. The signals we give, yes or no, or maybe, should be clear. The darkness around us is deep. I've worked in political campaigns off and on for nearly 65 years. A grade school kid, I helped my parents address envelopes for one campaign or another. I went door to door with them as they knocked on voters' doors. I went with them to the poll whenever they voted. 60 years ago, I organized some sixth grade classmates, a bipartisan group, three of us for Kennedy and three for Nixon, to write a letter to the local paper urging adults to exercise the right to vote that we didn't yet have, but were anxious to have as soon as we could. In my teens, indeed, I went with other teens to circulate a ballot initiative to get the 18-year-old vote. And I made the New York Times as a high school student when I went to a local event where the lead speaker was Robert Kennedy, who happened to be campaigning for the pro-war Democratic senator candidate. And I asked him if his support for the Democrat who was running against a leading anti-war moderate Republican meant that Kennedy was putting his party above his principle. Even though my home state of Oregon has gone to completely mail-in ballots since then, as have a great many of us all over this year, I miss the national ritual of going to the polls, of seeing people of all walks of life participating in democracy together as a civic exercise, a common exercise, of seeing friends and neighbors of all persuasions having their say. And when I used to work the polls in various capacities, and of course, those of us volunteering felt very strongly, there was a sense of camaraderie with those on the other side who, like us, were participating in the exercise of democracy, something almost sacred. It was more than civil. Sometimes it was celebratory. I remember the Oregon primaries in 1968, where there were hard-fought battles amongst both Democratic candidates and Republican candidates to win the presidential nomination. When Eugene McCarthy and Richard Nixon each won their respective primaries, people from each candidate's office ran out into the streets and started cheering and dancing and smiling, not only at one another, but at each other, even though, of course, we couldn't abide the other people's candidate. We still felt connected in our common passion. Years later, here in Pennsylvania, at a more sedate election, I was waving a pro-Dem sign at an appropriate distance from the nearby poll, and across the sidewalk was a nice suburban Republican lady with whom I chatted amiably. When a large, grumpy priest told me loudly he wasn't voting for a baby killer, she was quite upset, more than I was, and allowed us how that was highly troublesome behavior, and she apologized for it. Fortunately, he was the only person like that that we ran into. Back in those times, we lived in a more heterodox society. We knew and we were friends with lots of people who weren't like us. We didn't live so much in bubbles. We were civil with those we disagreed with. There were certainly ways in which we were segregated, but it wasn't as much by opinion. And we talked a lot to people outside our circle. At least my family always did. I remember especially my dad. We were at the shoe store getting shoes, and Dad would end up knowing the life story of the shoe salesman. The whole family knew Larry Stover, who fixed our appliances. When my mom died, it was Dad's Iranian gardener who first took him out for lunch and looked in on him when all his kids lived far away. He got to know the fishmonger, who always let him know when the fresh salmon were in, and when my mom died, sent us over gallons of free fresh chowder to serve our guests. There was a fruit stand, which in my childhood we always stopped by on our way to a neighboring town. And the man who ran the fruit stand had huge right-wing political billboards in the orchard saying things like, "Stop trade with communist nations." And my dad was always friendly and talkative when he stopped to buy apples. He didn't talk politics, but he didn't avoid talking politics. Most of my parents' Midwestern relatives were business Republicans, and my parents weren't afraid to disagree vigorously, but it never harmed their caring for each other. That was bottom line. I don't have to tell you that now partisan hatreds are at the point where lots of people have gone so far as to want to destroy one another. And it's not just the far right. It is also enmity on the ideological left. There is ire between people close together, the Lincoln Republicans and the Trump supporters on one side, and the liberal Enlightenment Democrats and the postmodern ideological dogmatic woke on the left. I don't know about you, but I am sometimes frightened about these divisions and the way we are making people into enemies. Sometimes people we have known and cared about. I'm not the only one who feels this fear. In the short term, not a few of us are afraid that our post-election period may come to violence this year. Many of us have lost friends and families over political difference in the past few years. Both the left and the right live in worlds sometimes of alternative facts. The truth is what is ideologically convenient and has become, like religious dogma, undebatable. There is good news, though. This extremism takes up our consciousness because the extremists are loud. Most people aren't haters, nor are they impervious to reality. The other day, I was taking a bunch of online polls with a cross-racial, slightly older, but otherwise demographically diverse group of people, evenly split politically. And there were questions, even political questions, on which there was overwhelming agreement. For example, only 11% thought Trump was presidential, while the majority thought Biden was. More than 70% thought civility had gone out the window. I remember all the questions, but polls show over all kinds of variables that Congress is split on: common sense, gun control, keeping Roe v. Wade, some police reform, stimulus for the economy, combating climate change, immigration reform. But all these things have overwhelming support among the people, as does keeping healthcare. But the extremists on both sides want to punish those of us who don't agree with them. So truthful, civil discussion of important issues is difficult, because you don't know when you might be personally attacked or even have people go after your job because your opinion is different than theirs. What has become different in these days is not that we have differences, but that we are cruel about them, attacking each other's character, trying to destroy people who don't share our exact worldview. And there's a lot of extreme silliness. I'm sure some of you read about the professor in Southern California who was suspended from teaching for using a Chinese word, Naga, in some example, and being reported for being racist. How can we, in our own lives and the lives of our community, country, and world, how can we do better? One thing in the future, when hopefully things have calmed down a bit, we can start again extending to people we disagree with the benefit of the doubt. We can stop being too quick to judge based on a comment they make or one thing they say, or just judging people quickly without knowing their story. People rarely behave according to stereotype. We've all known people who used sexist, racist, or anti-Semitic language who were not otherwise, in their actions, behaving that badly toward people in these groups. And conversely, there are lots of people who use all the right language who behave extremely badly. There are a lot of men, for example, who famously became the darlings of feminists because of their words or even their politics, who turned out to be sexual predators. I think of my ex-Senator Bob Packwood, and we can all remember Harvey Weinstein. My Jewish husband has heard anti-Semitic phrases like "Jew him down" from people who always treated him well, other than saying things like that. My grandfather sounded like Archie Bunker around us, but he hired workers that other Midwestern Republicans didn't hire. And he had more than a few Jewish men he regularly had over to his home for poker. When I was in seminary, we had to do internships with ministers who at that time were almost all men and presumably straight, since gay men were in the closet. Choosing the right person to be your internship supervisor was very important to your career. And as a female, it was even trickier. How the man talked was almost never a good guide to how they would do supervising a woman student. The other thing is that we misunderstand each other a lot. We don't know why someone sees the world as they do. We don't know the nuances. We don't know the psychology. We don't know their background. We don't know their education, their information. Yet another thing too is you don't know how strongly they believe what they say. The majority of us, if we're immersed in a group with the same opinion, will adopt that opinion. Many will change their view if they're around people with a different opinion.
experiments show that most people will conform somewhat or even completely, or at least not contradict a group norm unless there are one or two other nonconformists. That is the advantage of being in heterodox groups. We have to think. We can't just adopt the opinions around us. There's someone there who will speak up and challenge us when we've got it wrong and provide an alternative idea. And I myself will be an alternative idea, perhaps in a group where other people think differently than I do. They will hear an alternative view, hopefully coming from someone they like who does not have horns or is not burning down buildings. It's even better if we're friends, or at least friendly with people we have differences with. And we don't usually come together based on our differences. The most conservative people I know are my relatives, fourth cousins I met when we took a family heritage trip to Norway, arranged by a Norwegian fourth cousin. It was a great trip, and they are Facebook friends. One of them, whose strictly political posts I never agreed with, still posts opinions on many things I agree with heartily, frequently. My husband is in a cancer support group where he is a definite political minority. And yet he's accepted because they have other things in common, and so they listen to him from time to time. I learned scuba from a rather sweet, very conservative evangelical gentleman. I've been in ecumenical clergy groups where I have been very friendly with people who have very strong feelings that are different from mine on social issues and on religious issues. And it was a really interesting, constantly shifting ways in which we worked together. We were, as a group, pretty united on issues like hunger, poverty, race, and very divided on issues like abortion, gay issues, peace issues, even feminism. And the coalitions changed. Sometimes I was with the rabbi, sometimes the rabbi was on the other side. Sometimes the Catholics loved what I had to say. You never knew. Religious differences had to be bridged when we united a few times a year for interfaith worship. We started as a group with bonds and common concerns, and for many years before I joined, the bonds were superficial and not strong, but going deeper actually made the group more worthwhile because we could explore both our differences and our commonalities. And seeing where the strong bonds were, we could do more for our community. And sometimes we got some real surprises. I got a gift from a Muslim who told me I preached the true Islam. A very adamant Catholic priest told a friend that my views on abortion were the most cogent arguments he'd ever heard for the choice position. Presidential candidate Joe Biden remembers with nostalgia when there were lots of friendships across the aisles in Congress, and then many more things got done. There were two big differences back then. One was that they were friends outside of work. They almost all lived in Washington much of the time, and they got to know each other, and even families often lived in Washington and did things together. They built relationships and a certain degree of trust that you would keep your word to one another. Working together, building relationships, got things done, and it was good for the country. And there was a lot more variety. There are now no moderate Republicans and many fewer moderate Democrats. The gaps between us are bigger. It's not between us, but between people in Congress. And it's hard to compromise when the gap is wide and there is no middle and you are not friends. For the rest of us, though, it's important for us to realize that there's a huge middle. Just because I don't see something the way you see it doesn't make us that far apart. Our views, our politics are polarized. Our views, though, are less so. It's just that the folks at the extremes tend to try to speak for all of us and silence all of us. I think we have an opportunity this year, at the end of the year, and in the new year, to step back from the awfulness that's come to a peak in our nation. The isolation, the division, the cruelty, the intolerance, the purity policing, the violence. If we elect leaders who want to move us towards comity and decency, if we can come out of COVID isolation someday and be with each other, not just with each other again, but with each other even more. There are things you and I can do to change our culture toward a better outcome. First of all, we can get back to more in-person relationships with people and include people outside our ideological bubble. We can get off the internet more, talk on the forum even less, certainly text less, talk in person to human beings a lot more. Second, we can listen way better. Not with a view to how will we change the other person to have the right opinion, but listen to try to understand who they are and why they see the world the way they do. We can be a bit more skeptical about what the people on our team say and realize that many things we are just sure are true aren't. Many things we think are facts are only opinions. And where we stand office is decided by where we stand. But when someone listens to us, we may be more likely to listen to them. And it certainly helps us be in relationship. Third, we can refuse to join the increasing ideological cults. There are circles on the left, people we know, who are part of a purity culture, a call-out culture. Many UUs belong to the call-out culture. These folks intimidate and go after people who don't toe their particular party line, even though they won't necessarily tell you what their party line is. They quash dissent. At their extremes, they even turn into mobs. Comity can only survive in a culture in which we don't punish people for opinions. Allowing yourself to be silenced or even bending the truth to keep someone happy with you or prevent them from going after you or even to cater to unreasonable claims of sensitivity, that's not comity. It's giving in to ideological totalitarianism, common now in many corners of society, left, right, and in other places besides. If we bow to it because it's in our short-term interests, it gives the cults more power and it takes away from society comity and dialogue. Society becomes more ideological and meaner. Lastly, try to learn how to have fun, informative conversation with people of different views. If you hold a particular view, look at somebody who challenges it. Not someone totally outside your frame of reference, but someone a bit different. There are lots of public intellectuals these days, and we can get them on YouTube, and their views are not predictable. If you're voting for Trump, listen to a conservative who isn't. If you like Ta-Nehisi Coates, listen to John McWhorter. The other night on YouTube, I listened to a video by a young woman who was part of this walk away hashtag, which is people who have left the Democratic Party. It was a video by a young woman who was brought up progressive in Massachusetts and has become Republican, and how and why she got there. What surprised me was how much of her critique I agreed with entirely, even though I think there are better choices than going the way she did. But it could be fun to talk to someone like that, and I wish more progressives would listen to how we are pushing people away. There's an old joke that if there were a path that forked and the sign pointing to the right said to heaven, and the sign on the left said to a discussion group about heaven, all the UUs would go to the left. I would like us to go to a society where we could talk about things amiably and honestly, like the UUs discussing heaven, without thought policing and punishment. A society in which we know people with different experiences and backgrounds, and where none of us lives in such a bubble that we think all good people see things as we do. Living in such a bubble that we don't have to think because others will think for us. The best things about the liberal enlightenment from which both our religion and our democracy sprung is that the whole is greater than its parts, that truth is not received once and for all, but honed through thought and discovery. And that is how we can come to agreements that benefit us all, and then how we can develop enough community that we care for one another across our differences.
So thank you, Reverend Kate. You've given us a lot to think about and challenged us in some particular ways. This is the time in our service where we take a time to listen to the joys and the concerns that we're holding within ourselves. Joys that lighten our spirit, or sorrows or concerns that weigh us down. And so let's take a moment to listen to those joys and those sorrows. And let's also take a moment to reflect a little bit more, to linger just a little while longer in the words that we just heard from Reverend Kate and in this service, and see what gleanings you have from the sermon. So we'll have a musical interlude for a time for you to reflect on those. And if you care to share with us a joy or a concern or sorrow or a particular gleaning from the sermon, let's take this time where we share with each other the matters of our heart. So let's listen to the interlude, and following that, we'll get some instructions on how we could share. Thank you. whatever joy or concern you might be holding in your own heart, know you do not need to hold that alone, that you are surrounded by a circle of compassion and care, and that we are here to hear you, to be with you, to celebrate, and to hold your concern with you. So spoken or not spoken, know that you have been heard and we are willing to hear you. Let's sing together Spirit of Life as a way to hold up our own experiences and the experiences of one another. So as I prepare to extinguish this chalice, I want us to linger just a little bit more in the light of truth, in the warmth of love. Take what you need of this light. Take what you need of this warmth to help you move through this week and all the days of your life. Our closing words are also going to be unison words that we'll say together. And while I'm thinking of it, I want to invite any of you who have a chalice at home to bring it with you to our online worship services so that when we do a unison reading or an extinguishing, we might do it together as a group. So these words I've chosen are from T.S. Eliot's poem, and some of you may recognize it. So let's say these closing words together. We shall not cease from exploration. And the end of all of our exploring will be to arrive where we started and know the place for the first time. So may it be. Amen.